Well, as we approach the spring holy days, we like to have messages that help us get ready. As we talked about, we're having a number of messages on self-examination. But as we look at what's coming on, last time I was here, we talked about the battle that's going on within each and every one of us. And I would like to delve a little deeper into one aspect of that, something that can become a stumbling block for us, something that can set us back as we try to examine ourselves. So if we can get this out of the way before we get into earnest, going through in great detail of our self-examination, it will help. Now, some of the habits that we have are good. Some of us have really good habits, and they say if you do something a certain number of times, it becomes a habit. Others, we have bad habits. And some habits we have, we don't even know that we have. Somebody will tell us, do you know you do this? And you say, I had no idea I do that. You know, card players will have what they call tells, and they don't even know they're doing it. But if you're observant and you happen to know, you know when somebody is got a good hand or whether they're bluffing or not. And the person has no idea they're even transmitting this out to others. What's worse, if you have a problem that you don't even know that's there, it's doing damage to you, and it's just festering under the surface. So it sneaks up on you, it masks itself as something else, and when you finally do realize that you have an issue, a problem, you struggle even more so trying to get rid of it. So I would like to talk about that today. The good news is that it is possible to deal with this. It's an emotion. I didn't realize it was considered an emotion, but according to psychologists, resentment is an emotion. And we had in our speaking assignment class, we had everyone use the same exact outline, and yet two of the men came up with almost the exact same title, which I found interesting. How interesting that even though they're using the same outline, they would come up with the same title. And the titles used the letters R in them. One was We All Need Some R&R. And the other one was the R&R of repentance and recovery, I think, or something to that effect. And I thought, isn't that interesting that they both used a very similar title? And it got me thinking, you know, titles can be gimmicks, I guess, but they also are there to kind of help us remember a message. So I thought, since this isn't a sermonette, it's a sermon, I would go one better and come up with three R's. So today you're going to get three R's for getting rid of resentment. So while the idea of solving this problem with a gimmick like three R's may not sound effective, it's simply a way of reminding us of steps that will help us to get resentment out of our lives. And if it is in there, if we have it lying under the surface and we don't even know that it's there, it is damaging us. It is wrecking us from the inside out. Now, the term resent or resentment is not found in your Bible. The word itself has only been around since about the 1600s. So if you want to find the concept of resentment in your Bible, you're going to want to look at a different word, or maybe even a couple of different words. And we have words in modern world we call things like grievances. And grievances are where we have something against somebody else, but it's based upon a set of reasons that are considered justified. So they'll say in a workplace, it's okay to have a grievance that must be resolved. It's not a problem of the person who has the grievance. It's the problem of the situation that caused the grievance in the first place. But the word in our Bible oftentimes for resentment is the word bitterness. And if you do a word study on that, you will find it in a number of places. Now, the emotion of resentment is something that can sneak up on us and mask itself as something else. Oftentimes, we think of ourselves as having righteous indignation, especially if somebody does something to us that we see as highly offensive and highly inappropriate. And so we see that and we say, that was wrong. And it bothers us. And oftentimes we want to, you know, correct the person who have done this to us. Or maybe we witness it on behalf of somebody else. And we see somebody else has been offended and we feel we need to step in and solve the problem or at least make sure the person is aware of it. Now, the 12th chapter of Hebrews delves a little bit into this topic. And although you would not notice it when you do a cursory reading, it's in there. And I'd like you to turn over to Hebrews. We're going to start a little bit into Hebrews 11. And we're going to see what it has to tell us on this topic of resentment. Now, obviously, Hebrews 11 is the faith chapter. We've read it, and we've covered parts of it many, many times. But you know what doesn't get covered? The end of chapter 11. It's not that it's unworthy to be read. It's just oftentimes the point that's being made in the faith chapter is to bring out the individuals that have set a good example, that have come before us. You know, we have people in there like Abel. We have people like Abraham, Sarah, Enoch. We have Noah. We have, you know, all of these people that have these wonderful biblical stories, and we look to them as examples. But as you continue on through and you get past talking about Rahab even, it starts to talk about a subject that it is important to set up before we get in to talk about resentment. And so we need a foundation. So in Hebrews 11, starting in verse 32, and we'll read through the end of the chapter, it says, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped by the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, and became valiant in battle, and turned to flight the armies of the aliens." So these are all wonderful things, and our Bible Old Testament survey will show all of these stories about all of these valiant people that have come before, have done, listened to what God told them to do, and have done those wonderful things, which is why we often read the book of Hebrews, especially chapter 11, is to hear about some of those things. But as we keep going, we start to see another side of sort of the history of God's people. It says, "And others," women received their dead raised to life again, "and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection." So people, God's people, have been tortured unto death, and they did not give in to their tormentors because they saw what God was promising was better than what relief was being offered to them by their tormentors. And the Old Testament can seem quite harsh when you look at all of the death, all of the war. And when you start realizing some of the things that those people went through, it was truly horrific. And it goes on in verse 36. "Still others had the trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains of imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were slain with the sword. They wandered in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented." I mean, that seems bleak. Verse 38, "of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these things, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. So all of these people that went through this horrible, horrible existence to the end of their day, some of them, they never saw the promise that they believed in up until their death. They're waiting for that promise in the resurrection. God, having provided something better for us, that they should not know, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So he's saying, look, it's not that only those people are going to suffer. God is working with all of us, and all of us are going to be going through tough times. All of us will have things that we have to deal with, and we are expected by God to overcome the world and to deal with whatever that we have ahead of us. So with that as a foundation, let's go into Hebrews 12. Now, we've read this Hebrews 12, 1 many times, but I'd like you to think of verse 1 in context of the horrible suffering we just read about, because this is what comes immediately after that section. Therefore, also since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with the endurance the race that is set before us. What is it that weighs us down? All of us have something. All of us have character flaws. All of us have weaknesses. All of us stumble through all of the trials, and we talked in the last sermon about the war within us and how Satan is out to get us every single day. And what we're reading in Hebrews is, yes, you're going to have all of those weaknesses and all those troubles, but compared yourself to those people that suffered far worse, it's up to us to succeed and not let those things that weigh us down overcome us. As we keep going here, it says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who is for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. Now, why would considering what Jesus had to suffer, hostility, mockings, all of the insults and whatnot that he endured, why does that help us when we go through things? Because we're supposed to say, look, how can I be discouraged because I've been oppressed, I've been attacked, I've been persecuted, or I've had to deal with this such and such individual in my life, and therefore that gives me the right, we'll call it that, or the privilege, as some of us treat it as, to feel resentment and to hold a grudge against somebody else. When we have been attacked or we've been abused, it plays on our mind. And Hebrews is telling us, look, what Jesus went through as a perfect being was far worse than any of us as imperfect people at best, even though we might have gone through something that was unwarranted, uncalled for. We're all sinners, and we've all earned death. So anything that we have received as abuse, as bad as it is and how it should not have happened, it's still less than we've already earned, which is our own death, is what the point that's being made. And then in verse 4, notice this. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. So all those people in the Old Testament that were sawn in two, that were run through with the sword, that were burned at the stake, and all of these horrible, horrible things, they resisted unto bloodshed. They resisted unto death. He's saying, you haven't done that yet. Right now, these are the good old days right now. When the tribulation comes, it's not going to be like this. It's going to be far worse. And that is the point that's being made here. Remember, the book of Hebrews was written sometime just a handful of years before the Jewish revolt against the Romans. So the Jewish revolt was in 66 AD. Hebrews was probably written somewhere between 62 and 64 AD. So just a couple of years before that. And I wonder how many of the people later in life look back at this chapter 12 and verse 4 going, yeah, I remember those days when I hadn't yet resisted unto bloodshed. And now I look back at those times as the good old days. The book of Hebrews has a way of cutting through a lot of things that transcend centuries. So when they talk about different topics here, you can say, you know, that is just as real today as it ever was. And persecution is one of those things that God's people have had to suffer through from the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve were persecuted by the serpent. So compared to those people, who has suffered the kind of trials that some of these people have? Very few, if any. But that doesn't mean people today don't suffer. Oftentimes we suffer in ways we don't even recognize. There are some people that lash out. They have, as a coping mechanism, anger. And generally, they expel their anger until it's gone. And now they don't have any more until they have another reason to get angry. Other people have the exact opposite approach. Every time something comes at them, they bury it. And they don't deal with it. And it just stays under the surface. And you try to forget about it. And you try to go on with your life. Neither of those approaches are good. But it is human nature. And people generally do what their nature wants them to do. So if you are somebody that generally doesn't act out a lot, kind of buries things. They say that buried feelings never die. That was, a book somebody told me about once. But if they're there and you don't know about them, then you're stuck trying to get rid of them. So the first R that we're going to talk about today is recognition. Recognition. You cannot fight what you cannot see. You can get on your knees and you can say, God, I forgive all of those people that I have anything against, and I thank you for forgiving me. And you feel like I've just wiped the slate clean. There's nothing left. I've just forgiven everybody. But you don't even know if you have certain kinds of resentment, especially if they've been buried for years. I remember, I've told you in the last sermon about going through different trials at jobs, and my last job that I had before this one was the first time in my life I had to deal with active persecution. And when I had that, I was really kind of taken aback by that because I hadn't had to deal with it up to that point. And so I figured, you know, I'm a grown-up. I can handle this. And you go through the process of forgiving people, as we do when something bad happens. And you're always hearing sermons on different examples. Jesus, when he was being killed, he says, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Stephen, likewise, asked the sin not be charged to those people that were stoning him. And so we think to ourselves, look, if somebody's calling me names or somebody is trying to take my job or they are, even back, some of us can remember back as a kid, everybody has seen a bully. Whether you had a bully come after you or not, you know who they were. Everyone knew who the bullies were. And bullies would go and they would intimidate. That's what they did. And they would intimidate whoever was the type of person that internalized. Bullies didn't go after people that blew up because there was no payoff. Chances are, if a bully was going to go after someone who was going to blow up and stand up to them, they were going to have it out, and that was going to end whatever bullying was going to take course with this person. But if you go up to somebody and you bully them and you take their lunch money and you get away with it, then you see, well, how far can I go with this? And you keep persecuting somebody. That person that is being bullied is going to take a resentment from that, and it's going to carry with them possibly out throughout their entire life. And some people end up in therapy for the rest of their lives because of childhood traumas. And it's awful what some kids will do to other kids. It's worse what some adults do to kids. Again, abuse is an awful, awful thing. And when we are the receivers of abuse, however it comes at us, it's very easy to form a resentment. And you might think that I have forgiven that person, I have let it go, I'm no longer bothered by that. And then you find yourself in a conversation, you're just recounting it, and you start noticing your blood pressure going up. And you start noticing yourself get angry. And before you know it, it's occupying your thoughts, as they say, living rent-free in your head. And at some point you start realizing, I still have resentment. I still am bothered by this. I thought I had put this away years ago. So it is really important that we recognize that resentment can live under the surface and be open to the idea that we might have things that need to be rooted out, especially as we approach the Days of Unleavened Bread and we're thinking about finding leaven in our lives. Leaven in our lives are not just simple character flaws. They're not just simply simple mistakes that we make over and over again and we're happy that God reveals them to us. What the lesson's supposed to teach us is there are things that have to be found in our lives that aren't easy right off the top of our head to even know what they are, much less where they are, and then how to get rid of them. And so the process of going through and cleaning our houses is a rehearsal to, in our mind, say, I'm putting my brain into find the problem mode, and so that when God reveals things to me, I'm already in my mind receptive to the idea that God is going to help me get rid of these things from my existence. Continuing on in Hebrews 12, verse 14, it says, pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Now that verse all by itself, think about it, what it's actually saying. We all can grasp the idea of pursuing peace. Nobody should be out there looking for trouble. There should be no bullies in the room. There should be nobody in here that's going out looking to push anybody's buttons. We should be out there trying to find peace and obviously not causing any trouble. But notice what it says here. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. So we will not end up in the kingdom if we don't have the desire and the effort to pursue peace with everybody out there, even those people that we might think that we've forgiven, we have in some cases forgotten about, but then some flashback, some memory, some situation comes up, and it's like it was yesterday all over again, and we are bothered by it all, just like it was when it was fresh. And you find yourself in the middle of the night waking up angry or stressed out. And stress can cause, especially because of resentment, can cause all kinds of physiological problems and health issues. So we definitely want to do that. And we continue on in verse 15, looking carefully, which is what we talk about at Unleavened Bread. When we are trying to find sin in our life, we are looking carefully. If you go into your kitchen and you glance around and say, I don't see any bread, I guess I'm done, that's not the level of effort that God wants us to put forward. We have to look carefully for sin or else it will be there and we won't even notice it, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Again, if you don't look carefully, you lose the grace of God. That's what it's saying here. Look carefully lest anyone should fall short of the grace of God, and then lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble. So notice this, root of bitterness, we can kind of get an idea of what that's talking about, a small little piece of bitterness that is living somewhere in our psyche somewhere. And then it says spring up. Just like you plant something underground and you might grow some potatoes and you got some roots on there and you put those potato chunks under the ground, and before you know it, it springs up, and now you've got a much bigger issue than you had before. So roots of bitterness can spring up and cause trouble. So it's not just talking about becoming bitter easily. It's talking about things that are in there already. Looking carefully, lest a root of bitterness spring up and cause trouble. And then they give an example here. And by this, many have become defiled. So many people have soiled themselves, their soul, with sin and with grievance because of a root of bitterness. It says, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. And when I read that last part, I thought, why that example? You know, it talks about him being a fornicator or profane person like Esau. And then because he had the idea that he sold his birthright for a morsel of food. And so you think, that's an odd example to tie Esau to bitterness, unless you spend some time and you look at Esau's life. So we all pursue peace, I hope. I hope we all look to start each day out with the best possible motive. But then when something bothers us and we don't even realize it, and we might just be thinking, look, that was just righteous indignation. Yeah, I bit that person's head off, but they needed it because, you know, they have a bad habit of doing this or that, and they need to be straightened out. And so we think to ourselves, you know, that's not something I need to repent of. That's just good, clean living to straighten somebody out that's doing bad things. But yet, it's warning us here that those types of things can drop a seed into our soul and begin to grow and take over us and defile us from the inside out. So let's take a look at Esau for a moment. Now, we know Esau and his brother Jacob were twins. We know that Esau was born first. We also know that Jacob had this peculiarity that in the process of the birth, reached out of the womb and grabbed on to Esau's heel and tried to, you know, grab him as he was being first. Almost like, you know, he had a conscious thought, I don't want you to be first. And so Jacob's name means grabber of the heel or supplanter. And it's interesting that Jacob spent his life living up to his namesake. He was always trying to get what his brother had. And what's worse is the parents were part of the problem. Isaac favored Esau. Rebekah favored Jacob. You don't do that with your kids. You don't take sides. And so you don't have a favorite and then pit one against the other with your spouse. Husband and wife are supposed to be one. And yet the parents, part of the problem, set their children up to have this root of bitterness between them. Where the mother could have been working with Jacob to get over it, she connived and worked to try to steal the birthright from her oldest son. I mean, what kind of mother does this? But what kind of father then takes sides also and says, well, maybe because one has a favorite, the other has a favorite. Or maybe he was first and then she followed suit and looked after Jacob. Don't know. We know that Jacob was a dweller of tents, so he was at close to home. Esau liked to be out hunting and out in the outdoors, and that's what Isaac respected and liked. So when we look at these two, we can begin to see a problem developing from a very young age. Holder of heel or supplanter was cited by Esau himself in Genesis 27, verse 29. I'd like to go back to Genesis 27 and read just a little bit about what went on when Jacob took the birthright from his brother. Now, Jacob is looked at as the better of the two because he sought something and he put his all into it. And so he's looked at as the victor. He got the birthright. He wanted it more. Esau despised his birthright. He sold it for almost nothing, and therefore he didn't deserve it. And people write them off at that. But I think there's more to the story, and it's why Hebrews calls out Esau as an example, a cautionary tale for those who are worried about a root of bitterness in their own life. Genesis 27 and verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son," he answered, and he answered him, "Here I am." Then he said, "Behold, I am old, and I do not know the day of my death. Now therefore, please take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt some game for me. And make me a savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat it, that my soul may bless you before I die." So this was this blessing that Isaac wanted to do for his eldest son. Now, if you read back previously, Esau had already sold his birthright to his brother. So in God's eyes, it was already done. So To some extent, what's the purpose of going any further? But Jacob did, but not alone. So what does, well, let's continue on here. Now, verse 5, now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son. And Esau went to the field to hunt game and to bring it. Now, what is Rebekah's responsibility here? Her responsibility is to honor her husband and to do nothing. But what she does is she meddles. She gets involved and she does what she should not do. Verse 11, we'll jump down there. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man. I am a smooth-skinned man. Perhaps my father will feel me and I shall seem to be a deceiver to him." So she devises this plan to cheat her eldest son out of his birthright. She says, "You go grab a lamb from your flock, not a wild game, and I'm going to cook it up just the way that your elder brother cooks that your father likes. And he's going to think it came from your brother, and I'm going to make sure it looks like it comes from you. And then you're going to go in there and you're going to give him this food, and you're going to get the blessing instead of your brother." Isaac was old. He was losing his eyesight. His hearing wasn't great. The two boys were twins, so it would have not been a huge deal for them to be mistaken by somebody who was losing his hearing and his eyesight. But the one distinguishing feature is what Jacob just brought up. One happens to be hairy, the other one smooth-skinned. And that alone would be enough to make him get him caught. And he was worried about getting caught. So, and then he, notice what he says, "I shall seem to be a deceiver to him." You know, you notice how he softened the language? He didn't say, I would be a deceiver. No, I would seem to be a deceiver. Not that I am a deceiver, because, you know, getting a blessing, there's nothing wrong with getting a blessing. You know, I'm just ignoring the fact that I'm cheating my brother out of it. That's all I'm trying to do. So, I shall bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. So he's worried. He tells his mother that because I'm doing this thing that might be conceived by some or perceived by some as a bad thing, I might end up be getting a curse instead of a blessing. So his mother in verse 13 says to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go and get them for me, the lamb from his flock." And so, you know, I don't know how this is going to affect Rebecca in the kingdom or how it affected her later in life. I have no clue. I just know this was an awful thing that took place. And verse 15 goes farther. Then Rebecca took the choice clothes of her elder son, which were in her house, and put them on Jacob, her son. So she steals Esau's clothes. And she puts skins of the kids, of the goats, on the back of his hands and glues them or ties them, however she does, to the back of his hands and on his neck, so that Isaac would be fooled if he actually reached up there and touched, because his eyesight was just about gone. In verse 16, and she put the skins of the kids of the goats on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. Then she gave the savory food and the bread which she had prepared. Notice she prepared, not Jacob, into the hand of her son Jacob. So what Isaac had asked for was that his son would prepare something that he happened to love. And then after he did that, he would then bless him. Jacob comes in, not only is stolen the place of his brother, but he's not even doing what his father asked. His mother counterfeited the entire situation for him. So Rebecca volunteered to take the curse upon herself so that the scheme can go forward. And here, part of this deceit is significant. Isaac wanted Esau to prepare the food himself, and Isaac was going to be deceived on this count as well. So Jacob was willing to participate and ends up getting the blessing. Now, when Esau returns with the game, he went through the process. And think about this. Esau comes back. He has hunted. He has then gone in and slaughtered the animal. He has then started this stew and goes through the entire afternoon to cook this up, putting in huge amounts of effort, does it just the way his father does, likes it. And it's not until he brings it into his dad that he finds out that he had been had. Verse 35, but he said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." And Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" I mean, the meaning of the name, supplanter. "For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." And he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Do you suppose Esau had a root of bitterness? Only the size of a Cadillac. And it haunted him for a long, long time, to the fact where when you read later in Jacob's life, he is convinced his brother Esau is going to kill him. And possibly if they had met earlier, Esau would have done that very thing, would have just up and killed him because of what he did. We're given Esau is a cautionary tale because any of those things could happen to all of us. And yet, in the final reckoning of it, Esau was told he was wrong because he forsook his birthright. He shouldn't have done it, even in spite of the fact that they worked to steal it from the moment he was born. He couldn't even get the umbilical cord cut before somebody was trying to take his birthright from him. And he lived through that his entire life, and it became a root of bitterness. And yet God says, ultimately, he's still wrong for giving up the birthright. And if you go back and read the conversation between Esau and Jacob when he did sell the birthright for a bowl of soup, I can't speak to how much he was starving or whether he was dying or not. It is possible, but you would seem to think that if you were ready to die and you needed food, you do have two parents that could possibly get you something from the cupboard. So was it, I often wonder if Esau finally just said, you want it so badly, take it. I just don't care anymore. And sometimes we do that. We give up. And God doesn't want any of us to give up our birthright, our crown. It says, let no one steal or take your crown, because they'll try. And it's up to us to hold on to it no matter what. And if a root of bitterness comes into our lives and lays hold, even if it's something we haven't done, Esau, there's no indication that Esau was to blame for any of the conniving against him his whole life. He only is guilty for giving up what he should not have given up. And it can happen to any of us. Which brings us to our second R, release. Only God can dispose of resentment. Resentment is like nuclear fallout. It destroys whatever it touches. You say to yourself, I got rid of it. I forgave them. And then you find out it's tattooed to your soul. It just keeps coming back. As much as you try. Years ago, I had a sermon of trying to giving things to God, and I used balloons, helium balloons, and I let them go up to the ceiling. And see, I let go of them, but each of the balloons had a string on them, and you know, and each of the balloons had a different thing on a different trial or stress or problem that we would have written on each balloon. And so you say, I've just released all my problems to God, and they're gone. And then before you know it, you grab one. It's just that the string is right in front of you. Even though the balloon's up there, it's so easy to grab it back. And now you're holding on to that problem again that you've released to God. And before you know it, you're holding two balloons. And before you know it, you're holding all your balloons again. But you gave them to God. And that is part of that battle that we talked about last time, where the flesh inside of us is susceptible to all these things. The mind is telling us, I don't want any of these, but the body is saying, oh, I want my pain. I want my sorrow. That's what my blanket of comfort is. So we have to find a way to release it to God. And it is not an easy thing to do. We'd like to believe we can do it ourselves, but we can't. But as Romans tells us, that the way that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us, it's true, but it's not as simply as saying, Christ is in me, therefore it's gone. Not if it's something that part of us are holding on to and we've got a death grip on. So we have to, now Stephen, he didn't have any deep-seated resentment that prevented him from forgiving those people who were stoning him. Although when he was reading the riot act to them, you would think he did, because he seemed to be pretty upset by the things that the Pharisees had done, had rejected Jesus Christ. But yet he didn't hold on to it, and he let it go, and he just says, you know, do not charge any of these people with their sin. You know, we may relive the trauma over and over, no matter how many times we try to let go of it. And so we have to recognize that there is a process to getting rid of something. And it takes a protocol, it takes an approach that isn't necessarily the easiest thing that comes to mind. You know, if you've got something you don't want, and you give it away to someone and they come and pick it up, we're glad that it's gone. You know, somebody gets an old couch that you don't want anymore, and the chances of you sneaking into their house and stealing that old couch back is not very bright, and not very likely, is it? But for traumas, for resentments, these are things we generally will try to take back for ourselves. Psalms 143 has a formula that King David gives as a lifeline to how we approach righteousness, and it can be used to get rid of and release resentment or bitterness in our lives. Psalm 143, if you'd like to turn over there. Psalm 143, 1 through 12, a psalm of David. It says, "Hear my prayer, O Lord." So we're already setting the stage. David is seeking God's help. So what is he seeking God's help about? "Give ear to my supplications. In your faithfulness, answer me. And in your righteousness, do not enter into judgment with your servant." So he's saying, please don't judge me, because he realized that he's at fault. He's got problems. And he's asking, do not go into judgment. That doesn't mean that he's saying that what he did is okay. Judgment is looked at here as condemnation. Do not condemn me for my faults, is what he's saying. "Do not enter into judgment with your servant, for in your sight no one living is righteous." Verse 3, "For the enemy has persecuted my soul." So he's admitting here that what the problems I have are deeply ingrained in me. "He has crushed my life to the ground. He has made me dwell in darkness like those who have been long dead." That's what resentment, trauma, can do to us. It can rob us of life. It can take away light in our life. It crushes us. It persecutes us down to our very soul. Verse 4, "Therefore my spirit is overwhelmed within me. My heart within me is distressed. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all your works. I muse on the work of your hands. I spread out my hands to you. My soul longs for you like a thirsty land." See, these are all the things I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do all the right things, and yet I am just crushed from the inside out because of what I've gone through. And so he's asking God for mercy, and he's telling him, I've got a real problem. The second half of this starts to talk about a solution. So we've identified the problem. Now what can we do toward a solution? "Lord, my spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, lest I be like those who go down into the pit." And then these are the things he's asking God to do. This is the recipe for releasing your burdens. It's not just simply take these problems from me so I can be without them. That would be lovely. And I'm sure you've done that. I've done that before, where I've asked God to take a burden from me and just have it be gone. But that's not always how it works, is it? First thing, verse 8, "Cause me to hear your loving kindness in the morning." We need to start our day with something good, something righteous. We want to hear God's loving kindness in the morning. Because he says, "For you do I trust. For in you do I trust." He needs to start off his day better instead of where he left off the night before, where he would cry himself to sleep over his anguish. Second thing, "Cause me to know the way in which I should walk." Don't just show me. Cause me to know this is the way you want me to walk. So I need to know loving kindness in the morning, and then I need to know which way to walk. So I'm pretty much going to need a step-by-step how to get through this day. Because yesterday was awful, and I don't want today to be the same. For I lift up my soul to you. Number 9, deliver me, O Lord, from my enemies. Now, David uses that phrase a lot. And you could say, okay, he's saying, all right, go get those guys that hurt me. And sometimes our resentment, that's what we are hoping for. We want somebody to get even. And God says vengeance is his. And so when we are focused on getting even with someone, we're stealing that from God. We're taking that away from God. God says he will repay. So we have to let go of it, because if we're holding on to the mortgage, God can't go and foreclose, can we? Can he? So we have to let go. So what's another way to look at deliver me, O Lord, from my enemies? The enemies are those things that are plaguing me, the resentment that's in me. Deliver me from this resentment that is plaguing me. It's tearing my soul apart. He says, in you I take shelter. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. So again, show me the way to walk. Teach me your ways. Show me what's right and show me what's wrong. He says, your spirit is good, and then lead me into the land, in the land of uprightness. Lead me in the land of uprightness. Revive me, O Lord, for your name's sake. So he needs to be brought back into the land of the living and to learn how to be righteous again. Because when we are clouded with all of our traumas and our resentments and our bitterness, it consumes us. It's all that we are about. For your righteousness' sake, bring my soul out of trouble. It's a process, and we start acting like somebody who is not plagued all the time, and we start filling our lives, just like when we talk about we remove leaven from our lives, but then we have to fill it with unleavened, because if you don't backfill the hole with unleavened, then the leaven's just going to fall right back in, like trying to dig a hole in the sand. If we don't put something back in that hole, it's just going to collapse upon itself again. Lead me to the land of uprightness. Revive me, O Lord, for your name's sake. Bring my soul out of trouble. And in verse 12, in your mercy, cut off my enemies. Again, cut off my enemies. If that's a real person, that's understandable. But if it is an emotion that is tearing you up, if it's bitterness, ask God to cut it off, to prevent it from going after your soul again and again. And then, again, we talked about being a slave to God. He says, for I am your servant. So the last request to destroy all those who afflict our souls can be looked at by being released from resentment, because those things are what weigh us down, as we read about earlier. God doesn't want us to be weighed down. He wants us to be light. That's why he said, take my burden. And Mr. Kruger talked about the yoke and lifting the weight off of our shoulders, because the yoke that Jesus offers us is so much lighter than the burden that we have, and we are burdened by resentment. So this brings us to our last R, recovery. And this is the first step of the rest of our lives. You know, when you have a group that gets together that deals with addiction, they don't say, once you quit, you're healed. You are free of addiction for the rest of your life. You know, the people in AA introduce themselves as alcoholics, but they are recovering. It is a process where you say, you know what, I no longer want to be the way I was. So this is the first day of the rest of my life. And you look at recovery in that way. You don't just simply say, I used to have resentment. I let it all go. It's now gone. Because we all have the ability to grab it back again. We all have the ability when something else happens in a similar way. When somebody treats you the way that somebody that you had forgiven them had treated you, it's very easy to immediately be brought back to where you once were. And you have another resentment for somebody else. And it can happen. It can bring us right back. Let's take a look at Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, verse 30 through 32. When we're released from the grip of resentment, we need to build on that recovery. And growing more like Jesus Christ, we need to start putting distance between us and those things, those habits, those attitudes, those emotions that we once have. And the more distance we put between us and them, the better off we are in our recovery. Ephesians 4, verse 30, and do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. These are ways oftentimes we use to deal with when we are stressed out and bothered by something, when something is afflicted us for many, many years and we blow up and we get angry and we lash out. We do all of these things. It says, put some distance between you and that behavior. Don't act that way any longer. With all malice, and be kind to one another and tender-hearted, which is very hard to be when you are recovering from abuse. Tender-hearted is incredibly difficult to do. Forgiving one another just as Christ forgave you. As God in Christ forgave you. And we've talked about this many times. If we can't forgive, God won't forgive us. And so when we have to unearth some of that resentment that has existed in our lives for as long as we've been around, and then we work to get rid of it, we have to, as a part of that, forgive those people when we are made aware of it, and then work to separate ourselves from the behaviors that caused us to spiral out of control. And we see ourselves going through, you know what, I'm getting angry again, I'm feeling my blood pressure go up, I need to separate myself from this, I need to go back, I need to repent of this, taking this back. I don't want it back, I'm going to go give it to God again, I'm going to beseech him, and then I'm going to say, why do I have this back? Did I not start the day off with loving kindness? Did I not go through the process of asking him? And oftentimes the answer is, no, I didn't do those things today. I skipped my good deeds and my good behavior. I haven't done that for a couple of days now, and maybe that's why I'm falling back into old patterns. So we go back and we start at the beginning. We recognize that we have a problem again. We give it up to God, and we ask him to lead us away from that. And then in our recovery, we just try to put as much distance between us and that person that we were in that. Once we're free from that old life, what part do we still want to have in it? Proverbs 14:10 puts it this way. The heart knows its own bitterness, and the stranger does not share its joy. It's weird. Why would you use that word joy? Because bitterness is looked at so preciously by the person who holds on to it. It's like a baby that they're holding on to. And so a stranger would not share that as joyful. A stranger would want nothing to do with it. But for some reason, we do. We treat it like joy, and we want it, and we hold it dear to us, our resentment, our pain, and our suffering. Resentment, and there's a phrase, and I you're looking up the who said this, and quotes are this way, and generally everything is attributed to either Winston Churchill or Abraham Lincoln, but I found this one was associated to a number of people. Most authoritative sources said that Bert Gezi wrote this in 1980. I find this must have been around longer than this, but it's also been accredited to Nelson Mandela and Star Wars Carrie Fisher. But a lot of you heard this phrase before, and this is where it comes from. Resentment is like swallowing poison and expecting the other person to die. And that's oftentimes what we do when we are holding on to something precious and it is in our mind fermenting and it's just living in there rent free. So we definitely do not want to have this in our lives. And, you know, the three R's of recovery or getting rid of resentment is a gimmick, and there are lots of R words I'm sure you can come up with. I kept running into more and more. So recognition of resentment, so that it's things that are buried in our lives, we can find them, because we can't fight what we can't see. Let's release our resentment to God, as only through him can we truly be free of it. And finally, let's moving on to recovery and a life as far from that old behavior as possible. Remember that God has rescued you from death. Those two R words lead you to another word, redemption. That God has redeemed you from death and the life that has been called, you've been called to righteousness. Yet another R word. Yes, you can come up with probably a dozen more. I could have called this sermon 100 R's to overcoming resentment. But the fact is we have to recognize that they are out there, that they are in us. And if we're not willing to deal with them and we just leave them buried, then, you know, it's just going to rot us from the inside out. So let's work on rooting out resentment out of our lives before the Spring Holy Days. And as we are looking for leaven in our lives, let's have an extra look around to see if maybe there is something buried deep under the floorboards of our lives that is causing us some grief and preventing us from growing to our potential.